Welcome to New Realities. I'm Alan Steinfeld, and this program is about the evolution of our body, mind, spirit, consciousness, all those things that make up the human being. But the key element, I think, as we kind of move into this new time, is understanding the physics of evolution, the physics of consciousness, how we are actually moving forward in the dimension we're living in, as well as all those higher dimensions. So I have with me tonight two real masters of physics and higher dimensional physics and all the intricacies of what it is to be a life form in the physical world. We'll get into some of that. Try not to lose us. I have with me Dan Winter and William Donovan will be joining us in a second. And if you've listened to this program before, Dan is really at the leading edge of understanding what life form in the physical world is about and how that generates a charge that keeps us going as living beings. Would you say that's an interesting introduction, Dan?
Attractive to charge.
Attractive to charge, he says. So why don't we start off, because we'll be talking a little bit about zero point energy tonight. Why don't we give us an overview of the life system as it reflects energy, how you see that working together. I mean, most people think they eat food and they have energy, but I would say that's probably not how it works.
Well, it really is the energy itself that is the food. You know, we've been teaching for many years that the sort of physics of feng shui or the physics of biologic architecture was the ability to have the geometry of a structure such that it would attract charge. So everything is alive to the extent that it's attracting charge. And how it does that is by being fractal or implosive or centripetal.
Wait, I lost you there. So, okay, let me just take it slow. Things attract charge because of the structure that they are in, and that's the sacred geometry structure. So, or would you say it's a sacred geometry?
The term sacred there refers to sustainable, or is actually sacred space has been measured as literally fractal. So clearly the ability to be alive and sustainable and self-organizing equals the ability to have a geometry that's implosive, centripetal, or fractal.
So to define the term implosive means?
The opposite of explosive. It means it's a centripetal generating force, a centripetal symmetry. Mm. Example would be roses, ferns, pine cones, onions, which are fractal, self-similar. Right. And that wave symmetry, like a rose, causes charge to be imploded. The best example is a pine cone, that it gets about 4 to 12 millivolts from gravity by being fractal. And because it's attracting that charge, it is alive. If it were not imploding charge, it would be dead.
But everything that's alive is attracting charge.
That's right. That's right.
But not everything is fractal in that way that a pine cone is or a rose.
But those things that are more fractal remain alive. Those things that lose fractality die quickly.
Well, what about the human being? Are we fractal?
Very, very much so. Everything about us is based on golden ratio for that reason, from our bone structure to our DNA structure. So, you know, example of a fractal city would be Prague. Its magnetic map is a rose. And there you can lucid dream and have more life force. Whereas if you live in a square metal grid full of electrosmog, you die quicker. It's pretty simple.
So let me understand. So things that are fractal in nature, that have a fractal structure, generate more life force.
That's right, because they implode charge. They actually get voltage from gravity. They cohere the vacuum.
So we'll be going to be talking about anti-gravity and zero point, but so you're saying things that are alive are in a way free energy machines in the self, that they're gaining energy from the zero space.
Yes, we prefer the term cohere the vacuum rather than free energy, because there's a relationship between what you remove from the gravity field by doing it. But indeed, nothing is alive that doesn't implode charge, because that's what makes it electrically centripetal. For example, that's how you hold your aura together.
I'm starting to understand what you mean.
Oh, dear.
You know, I am. After all these conversations with you, I'm starting to actually get that things that hold charge are alive, and that's what makes them alive,
that's
because
right.
they hold,
right.
the Chinese might say, the chi.
That's right. That's right.
Or the prana. And there's some. So it's not food that keeps us alive,
no,
as we said, but we need to eat food in order to hold charge.
food is unnecessary. It's a beautiful thing, but certainly unnecessary. Lots of people live without food by attracting charge directly.
Now, how would they attract charge directly?
Well, for example, you can't do it in a metal building with dead air, but you can do it in nature. So, you know, a biology teacher who's teaching biology from inside an aluminum or steel building is doing the opposite of biology. Literally, it's a contradiction in terms.
So we don't need to eat to attract charge. We need to just be in nature. Let's say a harmonious, what we call sacred environment or something that's geometrically in ratio would attract more charge.
Well, when Professor Callahan followed the Kogi to where they make phone calls to their ancestors, great survival value. He measured the capacitance, the charge of the air, and measured sacred space, where you can make phone calls to your ancestors. And the charge density, the fractality, the capacitance of that air is called fractal, which means it's has a perfect place for a spark to radiate charge. And from there, you can telephone your ancestors, and you can have birth and death successful.
Well, did the ancients, though, they built monuments, they built mounds particularly that create charge.
Exactly, but we would like to be electrical engineers describing this. So when the ancients said, you know, if you can build a shem unto the Lord, you are sacred, the shem became the chem in chemistry and alchemy, and shaman, the word based on the same root. But the word chem was translated to mean altar in church. And Sitchin finally got it close to the meaning when he said that it means highward firestone. What Shem actually means, altar in church, it means a phase conjugate dielectric implosive capacitor. So you cannot know what an altar in a church is unless you know how to build an implosive capacitor. And that will create and sustain life force and prevent aging also.
But people must have built that or somehow intuitively they've created those things, altars.
And yes. But it's called the Hermetic Principle. The Caduceus is the map of phase conjugation, which is how you apply
it. So how would someone build, an altar that generated life force or charge?
Take the Ark of the Covenant. The dimensions were phase conjugate, and the relationship between the gold and the acacia wood was what's called a phase conjugating dielectric, which is a correct term for orgone. And in there you could for example, safely contain radioactive materials because a centrifugal capacitor prevents radiation, for example. So it's a good clue to Chernobyl.
To Chernobyl?
Or Fukushima. The real solution to radioactivity is a centripetal capacitance, which is why focused human attention reduces radioactive half-life measurably.
Wait, so what would we do to Fukushima to reduce the radiation?
It's simple. If you understand how to build a centripetal capacitor, you have the solution to radiation, absolutely.
How do you build
That's called a phase-conjugating dielectric.
But how would you build something like that?
Well, you know, a phase-conjugate dielectric is well understood to a limited extent in physics. They started with phase-conjugate optics, where you have self-organization. But dielectrics are understood by advanced engineers, and that is what a pine cone is. It's a very essential principle that if you know how to build a capacitor to attract charge, which is the end, which makes Exxon and Mobil obsolete immediately, you also know what life force is. So the very process of proving how to be alive proves Exxon and Mobil are obsolete. It's a beautiful thing.
It's great. Why doesn't everyone know this then?
Because they're stupid, really. It's so simple. It's really childish. The thing is, pine cones don't need Exxon and Mobil. They know how to get charged from gravitational field. And people know. So there's a certain quality of a dielectric called the dielectric constant. And Bill should be here. Bill's downstairs, but he's a real wizard on this. Basically, the dielectric refers to the quality of the capacitor. It's really the physics that should be taught.
When you say capacitor, the ability to hold charge is a capacitor.
Well, a capacitor is something you apply a voltage or pressure on the two plates, and it rings. And you measure how efficiently it rings, and that's called the dielectric constant. So it's like you hit a bell with a hammer, and if the bell rings with enough energy, actually the bell can ring with more energy than the hammer you hit it with.
If it's shaped right.
Which is a pine cone is a good example. So by definition, if the dielectric constant is high enough, that capacitor is getting power from gravity. It is cohering the vacuum. It's a zero-point energy device. And to understand what a dielectric constant is, it's like measuring the efficiency of a spring. If you press on a spring and you measure how much of that pressure bounces back, that's called the dielectric quality. Here's Bill. Bill's our engineer. Welcome, Bill. And so if a spring bounces back with more energy than you push down on it, then you're getting energy from somewhere, which in this case is a vacuum, which is what a pine cone does.
Right. So joining us now is Bill Donovan, who is really one of the finest electrical engineers, you would say, on the planet, right?
That's my humble opinion.
Oh, boy, I got a lot to live up to now.
No, I think according to Dan, and Dan's been around and he's checked out everyone in this field of harmonics and Sure. What would you call it? Fractality. Mm-hmm. If he says that you really know what you're doing, I believe that. Okay. So you're trying to find the key to zero point. Or
right.
Mm-hmm. Zero point energy means that mm-hmm. there's energy in space and nothing, and you're trying mm-hmm. to access the key to that charge, as you would. So,
zero point energy.
So putting what you were just saying in terms that Bill could relate to about
Bill, what I was just speaking about by a dielectric I got from Bill. You see what you're doing? You're visualizing that as the voltage wave goes to the correct capacitor, it's called a longitudinal wave, the wave enters what could be called the pine cone principle called phase conjugate. And it's like two pine cones kissing noses. And when the wave does that inside a capacitor, it's called a phase conjugating dielectric, which is what everything alive is, orgone, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Then you get a translation of the phase velocities. It slows down, it implodes, mm-hmm. and it sucks in the vacuum.
Right, and as it slows down, the amplitude goes up.
Before we get there, let's just talk about longitudinal lines, because most people don't know they even exist, these mm-hmm. waves of energy. So how do you explain longitudinal lines?
Longitudinal waves. Essentially, if you take a slinky and you shake it back and forth, you know, you have this thing in front of you and you're pushing it forward, pulling it back, and you see the slinky just kind of doing this this other motion. Well, that's a transverse wave.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but if you pull the slinky and let it snap back, pull it and let it snap back, that's a longitudinal wave. Now, okay. If you twist the slinky, now that's a torsion wave.
Okay.
So you've got three different waves there.
So, and sound waves are normally longitudinal, but most of what you're familiar with in electromagnetic waves are transverse. But mm-hmm. if you can make a longitudinal electromagnetic wave, then you have the solution of fusion and compression, all kinds of magic stuff.
But you're saying these waves are hitting us every single moment. That's what's giving us a charge, but we're not holding the charge.
But the thing is, it's to optimize the compression. Which it's when the compression becomes implosive that you get the centripetal force. And the compressional component of the longitudinal is far more efficient than the compressional component of the transverse.
So as far as how much is out there, Shinichi Seki estimated there's 10 to the 93rd ergs per cubic centimeter.
In vacuum.
Right. This is longitudinal energy that we can't really tap into normally. But, I mean, there's enough energy in one cubic centimeter to boil off all the oceans of the planet.
So, but the idea is how to access. And also, is this the same thing that some people would call ether in the ancient metaphysical thing?
Ether was another name for the energy, vacuum.
Yeah, you could say that.
So
yeah.
You're saying the longitudinal are actually waves that are flowing through everything, and if we can access that, mm-hmm. we'd have enough energy to do
anything.
Vacuum is sometimes described as ether or charge. The difference between a longitudinal and transverse wave refers to how much of the inertia of the wave is going up and down versus back and forth, as it were.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and you have ways of concentrating
the longitudinal component.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked earlier about an excellent example of that. When Ingo Swann made a flame with his mind, he did it at a distance.
Right.
And since he did it to a grounded screen, they measured that. Mm-hmm. It proves that his mind was making a longitudinal wave. And if the people who were building fusion reactors understood that, they wouldn't have wasted the money at Tokamak, because they would understand fusion, literally how to make centripetal force using longitudinal waves.
But so your work, Bill, and with Dan, is to kind of condense the longitudinal wave so we can actually create
to tap this energy, right.
Mm-hmm. So the point is that at any place in the vacuum, if the compression gets the right symmetry to be implosive or centripetal, which is compression optimized, and you need the arrival of compression from opposing direction called phase conjugation, and then the vacuum becomes implosive. That's the principle how a pine cone gets alive, and it's the real principle of fusion.
So how are you working on that, Bill? What are you actually doing physically to access that infinite energy?
Well, one way is to use a dielectric.
That's the right example.
What is a dielectric?
Dielectric essentially is it's a material that has a higher dielectric constant than the vacuum or air. The air is one and vacuum is one.
Okay.
And
think of a supercapacitor.
Right. Kind of like a supercapacitor, but
I don't know what a supercapacitor is.
Well, that's how the Abrams tank has a battery that Boeing would die for.
Okay. I'm still not sure, but
so anyway, the dielectric constant means that it has a more of an ability to support an electric field.
Now,
that's a conventional explanation, but In the non-conventional explanation, it has other properties. For example, it has the ability to slow down longitudinal waves on the inside of it. Now, interesting things happen when you do that. For example, you can produce gravitation-like effects.
But how do you do this? How do you slow them down? Before we get to the effects, how do you create the cause?
Well, you know, we're not going to go into the details of the technology because we have a patent and there's a process.
Okay.
But there's a geometry. It's a sandwich geometry where when the capacitive wave goes between layers like sandwich, and that's part of that proprietary nature, mm-hmm. but that as the wave slows down the center, if that geometry is ideal, then the whole capacitive field becomes implosive and it coheres the vacuum. The net result is a self-charging battery. And mm-hmm. Bill will describe that in terms of the electret. Maybe, Bill, you want to say more mm-hmm. about the electret?
Yeah. Okay, now with the electret, this is going back to Tesla's day when he made electrets out of beeswax.
Okay.
But he noted that you could produce an electret essentially is the same thing as a magnet is. Uh-huh. Now, with a magnet, you're basically producing a permanent polarization in, say, a magnetic material.
Right.
So that it has a permanent DC field coming in, which not really isn't DC at all, but that's getting into something else.
All right, yeah.
Yeah. But with...
no, we don't get into that, but...
Yeah. I can show you the math on that, too. But
no,
anyway,
it's okay.
Yeah. So anyway, so with the electret, what happens is that you take beeswax uh-huh. in a molten state, place a high voltage across it, 20,000-30,000 volts, something mm-hmm. like that, and then you have around 1% of that voltage that's still in there.
Uh-huh.
So out of 20,000 volts, you get about 200 volts that are still there.
I mean, after you shut off the electricity, it's still in there.
The molecules freeze in the geometry of...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of like a permanent joy buzzer.
So you buzz it with 200,000 volts, and then you shut it off.
Crystallize it. And
the beeswax holds the electrical charge.
And then it becomes a permanent battery.
Oh, it never loses charge.
A self-charging battery.
Oh, really?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And a pine cone is an example. And if you understand that well, energy crisis.
Why wouldn't they make batteries out of that?
Because they don't understand how to cohere the vacuum.
Yeah. Right. Now, that's a current free potential, which can't do any work. But there are ways that you can actually get that to do work. For example, that's another part of our IP, but...
Okay, it's okay.
But, I mean, you can actually you can actually add that current-free potential to another potential going into it mm-hmm. and actually get that energy out of the vacuum.
Ah, that's interesting.
So now, this is the fun part for me mm-hmm. is that, you know, we've been teaching the physics of consciousness, which is the physics of how to make living architecture, which is why anything is alive for 20 to 30 years. So in the same email that we inform Exxon and Mobil that they're now obsolete, we also inform the world that now they know what life is. You see, mm-hmm. the same answer to the question what life is, why you or I are alive, mm-hmm. is because mm-hmm. we are that kind of capacitor. Mm-hmm. And if we live in buildings that do that, then we can remain alive. We don't have to age. The same reason that Obolensky's device is sold as an age reverser.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The phase conjugation is time reversal.
Yeah, another thing, electrically, this is really interesting because there was a test that was done as far as the dielectric constant of tissue when it's wounded. Uh-huh. And normally, it's around 70 or 80. And
70 or 80 what?
70 or 80 for dielectric constant.
Oh, okay.
But if you get a cut or something, it'll drop.
The
tissue will drop to around, say, 20 or 30.
It becomes a bleeding capacitor.
Right.
This loses its capacity.
Right. This is Robert O. Becker.
Right. Okay.
But now if you put something like, for example, Hydrosil, which is what?
It's like liquid gold powder.
Gold powder. If you put that, if you put that on the wound, you see this stuff has a dielectric constant of up to 115,000. So suddenly now what's happening is that it's actually boosting that tissue up several orders of magnitude above what it was, and it accelerates the healing process.
This is liquidimplosion.com.
So why don't they use this?
Magicofhermes.com. We're doing this.
In hospitals, doctors, medicine.
It's a liquid Band-Aid.
It's a liquid Band-Aid.
If you make the wound into an implosive capacitor...
Mm-hmm. It heals.
Yeah.
The same way. But mm-hmm. why don't you speak about Obolensky's device a little bit, because it's a parallel.
Well, he's been a guest on my television show, Alexis Obolensky, so and he's worked with Tesla technology.
Well, and the principle
extensively.
Yes.
And the principle behind his device, how it's parallel?
It's getting into phase conjugation.
Implosive.
Uh-huh. Right.
For example, the Lakoffsky oscillator had a frequency signature like a square wave. If the frequency recipe is right, mm-hmm. the harmonics, like a caduceus, magic mm-hmm. of Hermes, that's mm-hmm. the website, implodes, and the capacitance becomes centripetal. And Bill walked in there, and his cut on his hand.
And it healed, and actually half healed in about 20 minutes.
In this Obolensky device, he calls the ionic generator, wind generator.
Right. And an ion wind is a reasonable term. Negative ion wind is implosive. We know that is healing. Mm-hmm. And you see how the ancestors call that, I will raise a shem unto the Lord. If you can make the stones in the right geometry, mm-hmm. you have age reversal.
But can I ask you a practical question? How would someone listening at home attempt to do it if they weren't an electrical engineer?
It's the same physics as feng shui. The feng shui mm-hmm. says, well, you shouldn't have a sharp right angle because mm-hmm. it's going to create death. Well, the physics is that's the opposite to a conjugate capacitance, and so that's destructive interference. So the same process by which you actually do true science of feng shui, make your house implosive capacitively, is how you make age reversal. Because anything that becomes implosive is actually doing time reversal. Time reversal in the specific sense, which is well known in the physics of phase conjugate optics, that you can only go back to a past which is more ordered.
Mm-hmm. Negentropic, less entropy.
Hello. Less entropy. More. You can only
go back to a past which is more ordered.
But the future is more ordered than the past, isn't it?
Well, the thing is, you have a piece of rust, and you want to take the rust off the steel. You can time reverse the piece of steel, and the rust will go away, only because mm-hmm. in the state of no rust, the steel was more ordered. But you can't go back mm-hmm. to a past which is less ordered. Very important principle of physics.
Really? Now, how do you go back to a past at all? With this phase conjugation, you go back to the past.
Well, they call it time reversal. It actually means reverting mm-hmm. to the previous state of more order. That's what it means.
Producing a negative entropy system.
That's right. Which is, self-organization was first defined in the physics of phase conjugate optics, but there's so few who understand phase conjugate dielectrics or magnetics.
Well, let's take a break for 1 second and talk about Tesla. Now, what did Tesla know that we have yet to know? And was he able, the myth, the new age modern myth, is that Tesla was able to access electricity from the air? Was that?
You're asking the right man.
Is that true? So what?
Or what was Tesla working with, which has been edited out of the electrical engineering books today?
Yeah. Tell us about Tesla first.
Okay. Genius. It's hard to do in a few minutes.
Tell us behind the genius.
Do we have another half hour?
Yeah, we have as long as we want. But tell us about the genius of Tesla, because here's someone. Electricity was hardly on the scene when Tesla came along.
Right. There was a handful of electrical engineers at that time.
Starting with, Priestley and Franklin started mm-hmm. to understand that electricity was something you could actually mm-hmm. direct. Mm-hmm. But no one understood really how to work with it until...
Tell the joke about Tesla saying the laws of physics are disturbed.
That was about Tesla's original alternator. So, and in fact, we're going to be rebuilding that one.
It's a good joke.
So anyway, so Tesla has this alternator, uh-huh. which is, it uses flux commutating rather than flux cutting. Every generator on the face of the planet right now uses flux cutting instead of flux commutating systems. Disobeying Tesla. Now, when you cut magnetic flux, you introduce...
destructive harmonics.
Not only destructive harmonics, but when you're cutting magnetic flux, you're wasting energy. I mean, you're bleeding off energy to do that. So that means that every alternator, every generator on the planet is designed to waste energy.
Like 75% energy or something.
So Tesla mm-hmm. goes to patent his new... Go ahead with the
story. So anyway, so he has this thing, beautiful alternator. It doesn't waste just an erg of energy. Uh-huh. And... the thing's over unity, though.
Gets more power out than in.
Right.
Oh, really?
Yeah, COP of 8.5.
8.5 times more
power. He actually invented this.
He goes to the patent bureau.
He tries to patent it.
He goes to the patent bureau, and the patent bureau says...
The patent bureau says that, if we grant you this patent, it will badly upset the field of electrical engineering.
The laws
of physics and electrical engineering. So then Tesla says, the laws of... electrical engineering and electromagnetics are badly upset already. Please grant me my patent.
I like that.
What year was that?
This was in the early 1900s.
And they never did grant him the patent.
No, they wouldn't let him.
No, they wouldn't let him have that.
He had to weaken it. And also then tell him the story about his carbon button, that story.
But that is such an important – that we had that machine today. I mean, has anyone tried to
– We're doing at least three versions of that.
Including the Electret and all of his other stuff.
Most of the stuff is Tesla. But tell him the stuff about the carbon button fusion. And that engine.
That's pretty good because now Tesla had this carbon button lamp.
Because he was making arc lamps. If you burn carbon correctly, you get the arc lamp that's ideal for the movie industry. So he was making some money with carbon button arc. And go ahead.
And he has these. He calls them actinic rays coming off of it,
which is actually radioactivity, wasn't it?
Right.
He was sitting like those pictures of Tesla sitting under those huge arcs.
Oh no, this is different.
But he understood the radioactive long before it was invented.
So there's this situation where he's talking to Morgan, J.P. Morgan.
Right.
And Morgan always loved to goad Tesla. I mean, he gave him a hard time. Mm-hmm. And that was his form of amusement. And, I mean, Tesla was usually unflappable. So then Tesla, he gets really irritated when Morgan says, why can't you be like this Einstein fellow or this other guy? I mean, they're splitting the atom. And he said, you know, creating radioactive elements and splitting the atom is it's against the laws of nature. And it will
Tesla speaking.
Right, Tesla saying that.
It's against the laws of nature. He said, we could provide all the energy we need from reversible nuclear reactions.
Say that again. Reversible nuclear
reactions. What does that mean?
Go ahead.
Yeah, and I mean, there's Morgan and the other guy, Adams, who was his secretary, scratching their head. What does it mean? Well, they wrote this down, but it's in the history right now. I mean, it's on record.
Reversible nuclear.
And then what Tesla did was he found out that there was something funny going on with his carbon button lamps, that he had carbon in there, and when he was bombarding this thing, there was and he got a spectrograph of the light, boron lines showed up.
So you start with pure carbon, and suddenly you got boron. Where did that come from? Hello?
Carbon is going to boron back to carbon again.
Nuclear fusion.
By splitting it with light?
Just the correct temperature.
Oh.
Right. Right after that. Now, Tesla was a utilitarian. He never invented anything he didn't have a direct use for.
Oh.
And then he actually patents an open-air X-ray tube. The X-ray tube was tuned to the K-shell of the carbon.
Electron shell.
The electron shell. Right. So what you do is you radiate the carbon with a specific frequency signature for these X-rays.
Critical frequency for isotope transition. That's Bill's specialty.
And the carbon turns into boron. It takes 1,000 electron volts to turn the carbon to boron.
Boron's an element, too, so that's kind of alchemy.
That's
with
literally.
Electricity.
Yeah. Exactly.
Uh-huh. Right. Okay. And then the beta particle, the electron, which is coming out of the nucleus from the boron, has 1 million to 10 million electron volts. So you've got over 1,000 to 10,000 to 1 ratio of the energy out to the energy in.
It's a little bit efficient.
Wow, so why don't someone build that machine?
It's too stupid. But
Tesla did. This is the Pierce Arrow.
His car, called the Pierce Arrow, rode on that principle. That was the engine.
Tesla built a car?
The reversible nuclear fusion car.
And has anyone ever duplicated car?
Not yet.
Paul Brown came close to that.
Yeah. Why didn't anyone?
Because people don't understand that the fusion process is actually a stairway between electrons that goes right into the nucleus, and it's tunable with critical frequency and electron.
Mm-hmm.
So he didn't run his car on gas.
It ran on reversible nuclear fusion.
Yeah.
How do you start that reaction?
Critical temperature, critical frequency.
And there's no radiation.
Zero.
Well, the radiation that was generated was actually absorbed by these copper coils that were around it. And he actually tuned the coils to the radiation as well. So the radiation, using the photoelectric effect going on. See, the photo, that's another, we could go into something else with the photoelectric effect, but anyway. That's why Einstein actually got the Nobel Prize for the photoelectric effect, because it was so important.
Einstein got it.
Einstein
Did Einstein know about Tesla's work?
Very good question. I think he did.
Some people say they never met. Other people say they did meet on the working on the Philadelphia experiment. So
yeah. And in other things too.
But this conversation could go into a very technical area, which is Bill's expertise, which is how Heaviside castrated Maxwell's magnetics by removing the quaternion, and that confused Einstein because he had no way to represent the rotation. But I suggest, since people aren't quite ready for that discussion here, that we take the conversation toward cold fusion in the human blood.
But anyway, to finish the story, the Pierce arrow. So, okay, so you tune the coils so that it absorbs the X radiation coming off of it. And the beta flux coming off of it. So it absorbs that. It knocks the free electrons free inside the copper coils. There's something called a multiplication effect. So you can get actually up to 200,000 times the energy out than you had going in.
A little bit of radiation. And that has to do with blood in another way, but that's an advanced.
But before we get to like the human biosystem, what was his orientation as Tesla? How was he thinking? He was such an original. Do you understand his mind and where he was able to access? I mean, there wasn't an electrical grid. There was nothing.
I think he understood the efficiency of getting charge from the vacuum and fusion principles, but I don't think he understood the relationship to gravity well, and Bill might correct me on this, but when he tried to convey electricity without wires, many people believe that he caused earthquakes, meaning he didn't understand how he was perturbing gravity.
Was he able to get electricity without wires?
Absolutely. Sure.
That was just a fission capacitive coupling.
Yeah, that's a magnifying transmitter. In fact, we have an associate of ours was actually replicated the magnifying transmitter, and it works.
So amplitudes without wires is a miracle. But if you don't understand the gravitational field's relationship to the electric field, you will perturb the gravity field with that coupling.
And so maybe he did create earthquakes.
It's getting into the phasing, because if you start producing harmonics of the Schumann resonance with this, then, I mean, you're producing these low-frequency waves that actually will cause the crust to ring like a bell.
He intended the crust to ring like a bell, but he didn't understand perturbing the gravity field.
No, but I want to understand how he understood any of this before there was even electrical engineering, like as a science. I mean, how is he able to get all these concepts?
Well, he had an intuitive grasp.
He could visualize how a wave was traveling. And to take that.
Another good story about that.
He could ride the wave. Well, go ahead, Bill. Go ahead.
So, anyway. So there was a story about Tesla and Heinrich Hertz. And
Hertz, and, Hertz frequency?
Yes, that's Hertz.
So Hertz was saying that there's a transverse wave inside of conductors. And then Tesla said, no, there are no transverse waves inside of conductors. They're all longitudinal. So he actually had a demo that it was going to, and he actually went to Europe to demo this thing to Heinrich Hertz. But Heinrich Hertz wouldn't go back on his theory.
So an example of this is if you put a copper plate on the roof catching the longitudinal waves of the sun, a wire down to your basement, and another copper plate, no light, the plant under that plant grows. And the reason it grows is because of the longitudinal waves, that's the food, because it's the compressional wave.
But you're saying the longitudinal waves are connected to the copper plates even though there may be dark in between them.
At the food, the compressional geometry. Because that's what, even when Nassim had this flower that did not decay when it's exposed to his implosive magnetic, the real principle, now we have the equation for, I don't think he did, was that it's the centripetal implosive conjugate magnetic creating the implosive centripetal field that actually restores life, eliminates aging.
So you were talking before about these longitudinal waves going through things and creating anti-gravity, and then we'll get to the blood, but anti-gravity, time travel.
More particularly, the longitudinal waves arriving in the right symmetry create a compressional geometry, which can, if the symmetry is right, visualize a rose or dodeca, then that makes it implosive, compressionally implosive, and that's when it becomes centripetal. And so that is the key to fusion and life force.
And gravity.
Well, gravity is the next step where if you look at the top-down view, for example, of a rose or DNA, 10 spirals of golden mean, the waves are adding and multiplying recursively, constructively, their phase velocities, because only golden ratio allows that. And when that happens, the wave fronts heterodyne, their phase velocity add and multiply, and that turns compression into acceleration. And that, in my view, is the only cause of gravity. It's why my new equation proved that Planck length multiplied by precisely Golden ratio equals hydrogen radii, meaning that hydrogen is a rose and makes gravity because its phase conjugate.
But this is your equation.
I wrote
Planck's constant
time, perfect, precise
times five ratio.
Precise exponents equals hydrogen radii. I wrote the new
equals
equation.
Equals hydrogen radii, and, which is the building block of the universe.
That's how gravity is made in hydrogen. But now the other thing that's cool.
Do you agree
about
with that, Bill?
It's a part of it, yeah.
The other thing that's cool about that, if you take the same Planck length and Planck time times precisely Golden ratio, of course you get the frequency of hydrogen, but there's only two frequencies that make photosynthesis go. You can Planck time exponent Golden ratio equals precisely the two frequencies of photosynthesis and also the orbital time of Earth and Venus, meaning the time itself is also phase conjugate fractal because that creates charge distribution efficiency, which is what makes time centripetal. So all these systems do not become self-organizing unless they're phase conjugate.
But you're saying the solar system itself is self-organizing as a life system.
Fractality and time is required to become self-organized, absolutely.
So how do we get to anti-gravity? How do we work with all that to create something that's, in a way, not against nature, but like manipulating nature for our humans' benefit?
But Bill, would the example of the Vimana be good here in terms of making gravity?
That would be one way. The Kosky Frost is another.
So we're doing a project to prove the origin of thrust replaced all forms of transport on the planet by creating gravity efficiently. Mm-hmm. And one way is, like the Vimana did, they pumped mercury in the right trajectory around a torus and made gravity. The Vimana floated, you know?
Vimana's who?
The Vedic UFO. So they were pumping mercury around a torus. And if you get the right geometry, we have the new equations for that, then you can make gravity.
Right.
So
it comes right out of general relativity because in general relativity, well, if you have moving charges in a helical motion, in a coil,
right,
you can produce a magnetic field. If you have a moving mass in the same coil, you're producing an inertial field.
And what kind of field?
An inertial field.
An inertial field, it means what?
It means inertia is the definition of mass, but if inertia is going in one direction, it's called acceleration.
Mm-hmm.
And so if the asymmetry by which you pump any high inertial liquid around a torus is what they call the impulse power on Star Trek, Star Wars.
So when Tesla wrapped a coil, a copper coil around all those, and then put electricity in, he created
a magnetic field. But if you do the same thing with a moving massive fluid, mercury, for example.
Why mercury? Because it's
high inertia.
It's dense.
It's dense. It's a dense.
You could do it with water. You could do it with water too.
So when you put mercury through a coil,
but the geometry of that torus, if you look at the origin of the alphabet, the golden spiral on the torus we created, Hebrew, the shadows are Hebrew. And, well, that is how, because that angle of that spiral on that torus is what creates inertia, and that's what makes mind. It makes it implosive. So if you get the right trajectory of this path of the liquid on the torus, you make gravity. You know, Nassim did that. He made a lot of gravity with his magnetic torus, but he didn't have the equation we do. It's called Navier-Stokes.
But you're saying mercury through a coil,
any high inertial liquid,
will create anti-gravity.
Any dense liquid.
Yeah. Will create an anti-gravity field.
Not only that, but now you can't create your own inertial field with you, and this is from Bill, and therefore you don't feel it when you make a sharp turn, which is what the UFOs do.
Mm-hmm. So how can you build a machine like that?
Sure,
that,
of course. We've got the parts.
No, that's on our list.
It's not even hard.
It's not hard.
The thing is to have the equations to predict the optimum trajectories.
Oh. So
that's called impulse power, which is described in detail in the engineering, the Vedas, where they describe
it. But you need a force to push something like a mercury through a coil. Well,
a pump. But that's about
it. But the amount of energy in that pump is a very low percentage of the amount of gravity you're making.
Really? Yeah. So what would an anti-gravity machine look like?
Well, the Pleiadian craft, you have this,
a typical, go ahead.
Okay, one way to do that would be, using the toroid. Mm-hmm. So you'd have a torus over here, then you'd have something similar to a Tesla pump in the middle of the thing. Mm-hmm. Then that would just pump the dense liquid
You need to know the trajectory.
In a toroid, like a smoke ring configuration.
Uh-huh,
uh-huh. So they call it an involute rotation. So that's one way of doing it. Now, the other way is something that Victor Schomburger was talking about. Now, in that case, bumblebees do it. Salmon do it. And it's basically a set of fluid loops on the inside. So if you do something like that, then you don't need the big torus. You basically have two nacelles similar to the nacelles that they had in Star Trek.
Right.
And now things get interesting because the equation for that, and you have to throw an equation out, is mv squared over r.
So, mv squared over r.
Mv squared over r.
Mass over velocity squared.
Velocity
equals
squared over r.
What's r stand for?
Radius. The radius.
Of the
movement of the, the material.
Okay.
So here's where things get interesting because, okay, you've got a dense fluid and it has a finite velocity. But you can do the same thing with a thin material, plasma, for example, that moves at a really high velocity.
You mean blood?
Oh, no, no.
Blood, plasma, or
charged gas.
Oh, gas.
Yeah. Charge is interesting because charge also gets into other things like the Parkhausen effect, Biefeld-Braun effect, that sort of stuff. So if you do something like that, for example, let's say you have something that's 1,000th the density. For example, steam is about 1/700th the density of water.
Okay.
But if you had something like a gas, it's 1,000th the density, typically like charged argon or something like that,
right,
and it's moving 1,000 times faster, though. If you do something like that, so it's mv squared over r. Now, it becomes a linear rate because what happens is that it's now 1 million over 1,000. So you still have 1,000 times the effect because you've got this moving plasma.
Mm-hmm.
So that means that instead of, now the logic would say that, okay, you have to have a really, really dense liquid. Not so. In fact, there are some people that actually went that route. For example, Robert Forward and Carl Sagan and Michio Kaku, I think, were talking about having coils with, you know, neutron star material flowing inside of it. Well, we can't do that on Earth.
Right.
But use a simple example of why a salmon is sucked upstream, as Schauberger, that the geometry of the salmon's body, but also the scaling, create a suction forward as well.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Very interesting, because what happens is that when you have a force moving in this curvilinear geometry, then you have a difference in the pressure on the outside inner wall and the inside inner wall.
Which is why UFOs are shaped that way.
Yeah, the fish is imploding itself upstream.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Now, if the fluid moves too fast, that means that the pressure on the inside inner wall drops below zero and the tube pinches off.
Right.
So you can't do that. That's your limit. You can't go any faster than that.
Right.
But up to that point, you can have a lot of nonlinearity between the pressure on the outside wall and the pressure on the inside wall.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is also similar to...
That's how salmon can defy gravity and go upstream.
Yes.
Yeah. They implode. And now, the other aspect of our origin of propulsion research has to do with something called Kosky-Frost, which I think a lot of that is beyond this audience at the moment and also a bit confidential. But basically, it is the difference between what they called impulse power, which we have just now been describing, versus what was called warp power in Star Trek.
What would warp power be?
Just in general terms, Bill, perhaps.
Now, this is interesting. This is getting into a story about Jerry Gallimore, who was a past president of the USPA.
Okay.
And
USPA.
U.S. Psychotronics Association.
Oh, okay, okay.
And this was a story back when I was trying to get permission to publish, and I talked to Jerry after one of the conferences, and he was in Las Cruces, New Mexico. And he was hiding out in Las Cruces, New Mexico, because, I mean, the DOD was knocking on the front door, and he was escaping out the back door. So,
but it's just that this was a particular quartz crystal cube that actually produced lift with the right radio frequencies.
Mm-hmm.
The point is that the government actually actively went and removed all the documents about it from every university library,
right,
meaning that the government is actively preventing.
So anyway, I got the permission to publish, and now this is after the anti-gravity handbook, and I had a folder with all the source material, and I lost it. And I moved from Illinois to Georgia. So I thought, oh, no problem. I'll just do an interlibrary loan and get another one.
Right.
It's in microfiche, right? I mean, it's all over the place.
It's called Kosky-Frost.
It's a Kosky-Frost experiment from 1927.
It was patented in 1927.
Oh, no, it wasn't patented.
It's just a
You can't patent this thing.
A quartz cube that went through the roof when they conjugated RF through it.
Okay.
Right.
It's warping.
So anyway, what happened was that... after the anti-gravity handbook was published, and this was in there, Then they went to every library and they removed the microfiche.
So you got all these,
The government
scrubbed it. They sanitized all these technical libraries.
So you had all these librarians around the country saying, what happened? It disappeared.
Yeah, that 1 month in September 1927 for Science and Invention, gone. What happened to it?
Who took it?
Wow.
It's just an example. Because,
but it was already published, though.
But this is an example of a fundamental issue here, which is that in the United States, if you even stick two wires in water to make hydrogen, the government shows up at your door and says, that's illegal because you're doing energy research. And so the result is that everybody in America that wants to work on energy is either under control of the military or they have to leave America. And that's the basic problem with the militarization of most of the world, including especially the United States.
Well, we don't have to – I mean, we could go with that political route, but I'm more interested in the science and the genius. And so if you were going to make an anti-gravity machine and you had this technology, what would it look like? Would you stand in it? Would there be a bubble around it? I mean, I'm being very basic here.
There would be a plasma field that would carry its own coherence. It would be centripetal.
What would the plasma field look like?
From a distance, you'd see it a bit of a glow. You know how they describe the UFOs. Yeah. But describe exactly why you would not feel it if you made a sharp turn, Bill. That's fascinating.
Okay, essentially what happens is that, now here's how, this is part of the story that Gallimore had. Mm-hmm. And he had this projector. He made something called a grazer for gravitational laser.
Uh-huh.
So he had this thing, and it would produce this coherent gravity wave, and he would beam it at the wall, and he was thinking of just yanking a brick out of it. Kind of like the tractor beam in Star Trek.
Uh-huh.
But he didn't have a DC potential on it. He had an AC potential. AC gravity worked completely different from DC gravity.
Oh, I didn't know there was a difference. What we do to gravity, is gravity a wave?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Gravity is the acceleration experienced by charge when it enters recursion or phase conjugation. Mm-hmm. So to produce acceleration from compression is called gravity. Gravity is that acceleration of charge. That's what it is.
Okay, so he's beaming this thing at this wall, trying to pull a brick out.
A gravity wave at
gravity
the wall.
Wave.
Accelerating charge.
Yeah, but what he thinks is a gravity wave. So remember, AC gravity waves produce quite different effects. So why it produces that is that you've got a standing wave from, let's say, from here to the distance.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say that it's 10 meters, just as an example.
Yeah.
Okay, so... And let's say it's a 2-to-1 ratio for compression to expansion for that wave.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so now the first part of the wave, 5 meters, compresses down to 2.5 meters.
Okay.
It's a compression site. The other 5 meters expands to 10. So the sum of the two is 12.5 meters.
Mm-hmm.
You gain 2.5 meters somewhere. Mm-hmm. So his projector suddenly displaces itself.
Oh, slams against the other wall?
Yeah.
The projection of the gravity wave.
Right. But it did that without inertia because it expanded the space in between the projector and the wall.
Well, that's a form of energy, isn't it?
It's sort of like walking
propulsion.
Into... Propulsion. Propulsion. You walk into Doctor Who's...
Oh.
TARDIS.
And inside is bigger than the outside.
Oh, wait. But getting back to that example, you're saying you're saying gravity... creates a kind of propulsion.
Well,
I mean, in the op-
right, this does. So every time you fire this thing, then it's going to wind up farther away. So, and when I talked to David Sarita about this, I asked him, David, are there any examples of stroboscopic motion in these UFOs? Oh yeah, they're all over the place.
What would that be? What would it look like stroboscopic?
It's basically jumping discreetly from point to point.
Yes.
Yeah, it's all over the place.
So you're saying they're using...
They're using this drive.
Oh. And that creates a warp. Could you go faster than light with this drive?
Oh, yeah.
How would you go faster than light with this kind of...
Well, let's say that you're jumping 1 meter at a time.
Okay.
Okay? And you have the thing firing 300,000 times per second. You're moving at the speed of light.
Okay. How do you generate...
kilometer per second.
But
yeah,
how do you... Well, I guess...
Yeah.
How would you generate a gravity wave?
Well, gravity wave is what happens when the waves converging at that site produce acceleration. It's that simple. Mm-hmm. And so in the same way you can focus longitudinal waves at a distance to make heat, you can focus those waves at a distance and make gravity.
But how do you focus it? How would you do it?
Well, the analog of how longitudinal waves cross to make a transverse wave applies, correct, Bill?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but in the case of the projector... There's actually several different effects that you would see from this thing. For example, I mean, you've got a boundary layer effect between this corridor where things are jumping through, where photons are being lifted up from the vacuum.
Uh-huh.
So you'd have a warp contrail. It's a luminous trail behind the craft. We see this with UFOs all the time.
A luminous trail.
Right.
Right. And so, but it also affects time. So talk about how time and gravity and mass and inertia are affected when you create these fields.
Mass is a name for charge rotating. Time is it defined by the same rotation, but it's the period of that rotation. So time is only a name for charge rotation.
But mass is a capacitance, too.
And so as you travel faster than the speed of light, you have the ability to win out of time by definition, because you can actually move in and out of those.
So you actually could go back in time.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. But the point is, you can't go back to a condition of less order. Mm-hmm. So literally, you only have the option of returning to more order. That's an important principle.
Well, but how do you know what's more order or less? So if you take your past or mine or anybody's,
take Nostradamus. He's looking at it, and Bill's an expert on this too.
You're an expert on Nostradamus?
Yes, he is. I say that he is.
Okay.
And at the bottom of his, he's scrying, which is looking at the surface of a black water and phase conjugating at the surface. But the bottom of the black cup is coated with a phase conjugate material. Nostradamus, which is to say time reversal by definition. And so that's how Nostradamus is seeing the past. But the other aspect is...
Or the future, even.
That's another aspect is that he's crying for those for whom he's seeing, which is the compassion, which is implosive, sucking the future to him. So the aspect of compassion is important there. And that's also where I wanted to go with this conversation. I know we're running out of time.
No, we're not running out. We could do as much as we want.
Just the point being that if we apply what we said about thrust to how you travel in a lucid dream...
Now we're really going out there.
No, it's very important. We know exactly, Korotkov measured...
Because we don't have mass.
No, Korotkov measured the human ghost after death. We know the physics very clearly. He even knows where the plasma goes and why, et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, you mean like 41 grams or something like that?
Well, yes, but it's also, he actually used the GDV to measure the plasma ball of the ghost after death. He knows where it goes, why it goes, et cetera, et cetera. It's very obvious, and it's all physics, beautiful physics. But if you want to lucid dream or die successfully at the same thing, you need to understand plasma projection, and that's exactly what this is. Remember in Ghosts where you couldn't move unless you could feel passion?
But getting back to Nostradamus, what did you discover? You were looking at his predictions.
Yeah.
How did you get into Nostradamus, Bill?
Oh, I just started reading the some of the predictions.
Bill has memories.
And what did you feel about... what did you discover reading his predictions? I mean, as far as physics and all that. How did you discover what...
Phase conjugation.
From his predictions.
Yeah, that's part of it, yeah.
But how did you discover that? What were you looking for in his... In his writings, or it just came to you?
It just kind of...
You know, the tower he was working in was the center of a giant magnetic pentagram. That is called phase conjugate.
So, if we take... So how would we... We have anti-gravity we can create, and we have time travel we can create, and we have zero-point energy we can create, and if we really had these functional, we would have a whole new...
Yes,
world.
But we would have to start with an understanding of what life is, or we couldn't be responsible to any of that.
Well, by the way, on the inside of the craft, for example.
Yeah.
I mean, if you had something on the inside that would produce a compressional gravitational field.
Something inside a craft.
Right. You've got 10 times the density on the inside as far as the standing gravitational wave than you have on the outside. Then you'd have... And once you stepped out from the outside to the inside, suddenly you're, say, one-tenth the size than you are.
You'd actually shrink, you're saying?
Yeah, kind of, Or from the outside, I mean, if you could see the inside from the outside, you'd be a lot thinner or a lot smaller.
But the inside would be a lot bigger inside than it would look like outside the craft.
Right.
Because of these laws of physics you guys have discovered.
Right.
Either that or they watch Doctor Who, one of the...
No.
Yeah.
This is all... But the other thing is, these ships also have a bio magnetic field. They're alive. So is there something about...
The best ones are made of genetic material, only in the sense that living plasma is the most self-organizing. So ultimately... all of this technology leads to living plasma itself.
But why do the ships look metallic even though they're bioplastic?
No. The low grade, you know, they always said if your ET arrives in heavy metal, you know they're from the wrong side of town. It's worse if they...
They're listening to heavy metal, Bill. So, yeah, they're from the wrong side of town as well. So how are you working with all this? I mean, you've devoted a career. Of course, Dan's been involved for forever in this. So, and, of course, you coming from a kind of mainstream world, Bill, into... Mm-hmm. This kind of
electrical engineering.
But we, I mean, far out stuff. I mean, you're on the cutting edge of electrical engineering. Is there any way the world's going to catch up with you like those? I mean, could you feed them some formulas and say, wow,
sure.
That.
Oh, yeah.
But they're stuck in their paradigm. Are they not going to listen? What do they need to do to get this level of awareness?
I don't mean to interrupt here, but my view would be that the fundamental principle of how any centripetal force is created, whether you call it gravity, whether you call it life force, or consciousness, in every case, life force, gravity, or consciousness amounts to knowing how to make a centripetal field. And current physics does not know the origin of any centripetal force.
So I'm talking here with Bill Donovan and Dan Winter, and Bill was just saying that in order to understand this advanced electrical engineering, which Dan says has to do with life itself.
Restored
centripetal forces. Bill, what do we need to do to electrical engineering to bring them really into the 21st century?
We actually have to go back to the 19th.
Okay.
And go back prior to Oliver Heaviside, because Bearden was right. What happened was that the elite, the powers that be at that time, which go back to the Rothschilds and Rockefellers, actually rewrote electromagnetics so that we couldn't get free energy.
Oh, they knew that we could, and
yes.
They changed it so
they changed it.
Anyone who would come after would
right.
Use these old equations. That's pretty ingenious, though.
It was pretty decadent.
I know, but how did they actually know that town would rewrite? Because they had some geniuses on their side. But anyway,
the web article on all this, fractalfield.com/mathematics-of-fusion. There's the background. Go ahead.
Okay, yes. So what happened was that back then, and this goes back to a question that I had to a professor of electrical engineering, when I said, how can a current and a voltage be out of phase if it's the same entity? So this is quantum schizophrenia.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then he said, I don't like that question. I'm not going to answer it. And just keep quiet about it.
Yeah.
So I still had that question. I wanted to know why.
This is why you were going to school and you're...
Right.
Because you're not just regurgitating electrical theory. You're using your creative mind to actually... understand it and see the loopholes in it.
Right.
So
at that time, in the early part of electrical engineering, there was something called the phonon theory.
Mm-hmm.
So you had, and the phonon is basically the cousin to the photon. Photons are essentially...
light waves.
Well, they're transverse.
Uh-huh.
Phonons are longitudinal, and they're also sound waves.
So they thought sound waves had... particles as well as light.
Oh yes,
particles.
They're phonons, right?
And
they're wave packet.
Are
right.
There?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so according to early electrical engineering, phonons are basically how electrons are. Excuse me. The current inside of a wire is transported. So, current conduction happens at that time because you have two different entities. You had the phonon that was transporting this potential wave inside the wire that carried no current.
Uh-huh.
This was flashing through the wire at the speed of light.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a clue. Travels at the speed of light. Electrons can't. The typical electron drift velocity inside of a conductor is only
slow.
In centimeters per second.
Very slow.
But sound doesn't travel at the speed of light. I mean, sound doesn't travel at the speed of sound.
This does. This is a longitudinal wave inside the conductor. And what happens is that the electrons actually surf on this longitudinal wave.
Mm-hmm. Right.
In the same way that a surfer on a surfboard is surfing the wave, electrons do that inside the conductor.
Okay.
So That's how you have typical electrical conduction inside of a wire.
But relate that to Heaviside and Maxwell then.
So what Heaviside did was...
Heaviside is the guy that castrated Maxwell's equations. That's
right.
Okay.
So he basically said, oh, well, you know...
Bribed by the Rockefellers.
He was working for the bad guys.
The bad Illuminati.
Yeah.
So he distorted... Okay, so...
Removing the quaternion, which removes the ability to describe spin.
Okay.
Well, that's
where we lost spin.
That's where we lost torque.
Oh, we lost a lot of things after that.
We lost the rotational control.
Amazing we had anything work after that.
We didn't.
Einstein
was a screw-up.
Yeah, speed of light is not a speed limit, for starters.
Get back to the phone. Yeah,
it actually gets into the electrical resonance of free space, and that's how Tesla did it.
Mm.
But, I mean, if you change the permittivity and the permeability of free space, you can actually get things moving faster than the speed of light. But that's another thing. So anyway.
That's a big thing. But okay.
Yeah. Anyway, so anyway.
Maxwell.
So getting back to Maxwell. Maxwell's original quaternions actually describe how you have multiple equation sets. Actually, in Maxwell's set, you've got 16 different solutions for EM. We're only using one or two.
For energy mass, you're saying?
No, for electromagnetics.
Oh.
Right.
See, the quaternion had four elements, X, Y, Z, the directions of movement, plus the rotational component, the fourth element. And it's that rotational component that Heaviside castrated out. So you couldn't even represent rotation when in today's equations. So you couldn't understand the relation of electromagnetics to gravity.
Or torsion. I mean,
there was no torsion field.
There was no torsional component to anything.
You couldn't even describe it without the quaternion, the last element. So Einstein
built an empty science.
Right.
You didn't even have the mathematics to represent the rotational component, which is how you could get gravity out of electromagnetics.
Right. And remember, the torsion field is a cousin to gravity, if not gravity itself. So that meant that getting rid of the torsional component to this equation set meant that you could never. And you can never link electromagnetics to gravity. He basically took, and this is using Bearden's words, he took the gravity side, sawed it off, threw it away, and nobody was able to put the toothpaste back into the tube again. Einstein tried that.
Einstein didn't know what the equation was stripped. He didn't have the quaternion.
So he did this in vain, not knowing the original equation set.
Why did he go back to Maxwell?
Remember that nobody realizes that there's a certain kind of rotation where down the spiral, where the phase velocities add and multiply recursively, producing acceleration from compression. The only definition of gravity. And you can't begin to represent that unless you can represent the amount of inertia in rotation.
Wait, is that why gravity accelerates the faster you go?
Acceleration is the only definition we've ever had for gravity. Mm-hmm. And you can't produce acceleration unless you spiral the correct way, the rotation, to add and multiply phase velocities called gravity. You produce acceleration from compression. And that isn't even possible unless you have the rotational component of the equation, which is the quaternion.
So Maxwell was unaware that his equations were stripped.
Maxwell
was long dead by then.
But why didn't Einstein go back to Maxwell's original equation? How did you find that out? How did other people?
They just went back to the fundamentals. Now, getting back to this phonon theory.
The wrong religion.
Yeah.
Right. So with the phonon theory, essentially what it says is that you can produce current-free potentials. That's easy to do because you've got this phonon component inside of the conductors. It's inside of electrets, for example.
It's just like you had, if you have balls on a string and the balls are perfectly touching each other, you pick up one at one end and bounce it, the ball at the other end, a billion balls down the road, bounces off immediately.
That's the phonon component that's going through.
That's a current free potential.
That's a wave. Phonon in the longitudinal wave.
Each ball down the row hasn't moved at all, but the inertia has passed completely through, potentially faster than the speed of light.
So are there phonons everywhere? Like there's maybe light particles that have to be?
That's not a longitudinal wave. I mean, we're basically bathed in it all the time.
And to understand the nature of consciousness and life, if you have a geometry that allows that charge distribution perfected, which is the stellated dodeca-Golden ratio base, suddenly that perfected distribution of charge is life and consciousness and mind and what you used to call the divine. It's sacred space blue.
Mm-hmm. So okay.
Here's a practical application. If you want to die or get born successfully, the ancients all knew you need a fractal heir, a place where the charge is, you know, centripetal and plosive, phase conjugate, and then you can have successful birth and death, because that's how charge distribution is affected. It's also why Ray Moody is saying, you know, near-death experiences are contagious. All the surgeons are standing around, and they suddenly realize somebody dies there. Everybody's sucked into the near-death vision. It's a plasma field that's imploding.
Everyone's sucked into the near-death vision?
Oh, yeah,
what
Ray
do you
Moody,
mean they're sucked in?
Ray Moody has extensively documented all the neuroses. The surgeons now agree that near-death experiences are electrically contagious.
What do you mean they're sucked into the near-death experience? They don't have it?
There's a sequence of visions you have when you die, Kluge-Forman constants. You're literally seeing the black hole being born. And that's the Kluge-Forman, the sequence of geometries you see when you die.
Well, what happens to the doctors, you're saying?
The doctors are standing over. They now, it's well documented, the doctors have now proved that the near-death visions are electrically contagious.
Wait, so what's happening to the doctors? Are they getting the near-death
vision? They're closing their eyes and they're seeing the near-death, absolutely.
Oh.
And all the high-end doctors, Ray Moody's document, what is that happening to the plasma? Biology is entering that geometry of space. And that's the only form immortality ever took.
I mean, consciousness is entering...
We documented the symmetry, goldenmean.info/immortality. It's all there, Kluge-Forman constants, sequence of visions you see when you die, designing sacred space. Mm-hmm. So living plasma does all this physics.
Living plasma. So consciousness...
is the ability to enter that charge distribution perfection.
But is consciousness connected to the longitudinal waves?
The longitudinal component is present when the charge enters that precise symmetry, which is why a city that's actually alive has to look fractal, the same place you have to go when you're born or die. Whereas if you go to a hospital electrosmog, you do not die successfully because your plasma is fractionated.
So the more we can access the longitudinal waves,
the fractal distribution efficiency,
we can build up our own charge,
charge forever,
charge radiance enabled,
and actually create an anti-gravity field around us.
So the technology here is beautiful, but it's understandable best in living terms.
So what's your vision then, Bill? I'll ask you too, of using this high level electro engineering to create a future. What do you see it? If we could get rid of all the government, you know,
interference
mm-hmm. and create, and you could educate the masses on the true nature of electricity mm-hmm. and electromagnetism and
the geometry of spirit.
What mm-hmm. do you and the geometry of spirit? What's possible?
Well, what's possible?
What do you see as possible? Yes.
Here's the problem is that right now we're in the 21st century. We're not living in the 21st century. We're still living with technology in the 19th.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we're basically 200 years behind the time.
So what do we need to do? How do we rewire our systems?
It's a problem because the military's controlling all the technology that actually reaches.
Well, that and education. I mean, right now they've rewritten electromagnetics so that and I can guarantee you, as far as the black world and the military stuff, they have the correct version of electromagnetics. They're working with it every day, and they know about this stuff.
Uh-huh.
So they consider the rest of the planet to be their enemy.
Well, do they have to reverse engineer the alien crafts in order to know this, or they would know without reverse engineering?
Once you know the principle, you know.
Once you know the principle, I mean, you wouldn't have to. I mean, you already know how everything works.
Yeah, it's... But it is a problem of education and self-empowerment. It's true. And, you know, looking at the problem of life extension can be educational in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
Again, the same reason that Obolensky's device is advertised as age reversal, that it's electric field that becomes self-organizing,
mm-hmm.
the only form of immortality that ever existed. So, and the ancients called it a Shen field, and it was literally a life extension field.
Well, do you believe then that consciousness remains intact after the body?
Oh, yeah.
If the plasma was coherent. Interesting, the name for that coherence, ka, is in Catholic or Merkabah or Cathar.
Or Kaba, means, right?
Yeah, the ka means the amount of coherence in your plasma field. And the amount of coherence, the climax form of coherence, is conjugate or fractal or centripetal.
So just to kind of go back to what you said and we can wrap up what's happening in the human organism as far as the blood being a fluid rapidly going through these tubes mm-hmm. creates a field effect.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, remember, the DNA is implosive. It's potentially superconductive. And then that implosion is triggering in the body a form of cold fusion, Bill, the magnesium to iron. And so the body's heat source is literally cold fusion. And all of that makes you warm-blooded, which is the opposite of being cold-blooded, which is defined as lack of compassion, you see?
Well, by the way, this also explains spontaneous human combustion, which is when the reaction just runs away.
Wait, so what happens? Do people actually take their body with them to another dimension?
Well, what do you call it?
They kind of turn into a pile of ashes.
Well, spontaneous combustion. But Kundalini is actually a climax form, and there's a microwave component, which Dratch measured and others. But what's actually happening is what you're calling the next dimension is the next superposed axis of spin symmetry, literally charged spin symmetry, DNA being the best example.
But what would cause a spontaneous combustion in a human being?
The wrong kind of beer.
The wrong kind of beer. Well, then that's another interesting point because back in the 19th century, when a lot of these SHC, spontaneous human combustion events were taking place, people were drinking beer that was brewed for a long time. Now, there's a difference between the boiling point of deuterium oxide, heavy water, and white water. Yeah, it's a few degrees difference.
And the alchemists used heavy water.
Yeah. So what happened was that they were brewing this stuff for a long time. So what they were doing is they were boiling off the light water, and then you had a lot of heavy water in there. But they were also using nickel in their brewing process. So you had ionic nickel, and you had a lot of deuterium oxide around.
In the wrong kind of beer.
Right. So people were drinking this stuff. Well, nickel's primarily toxic to the human system anyway, but it's even more toxic when you throw deuterium into the mix. It can produce reactions 10 to 100 times greater than protium or light water. So it's like throwing gasoline on the fire.
So it wasn't a mystical experience.
Well, you see, it's a very complicated thing because that's very real. But the other aspect is as metabolism goes to a climax, remember the metabolism is driven by – and climactic metabolism is plasma fire. It's awareness. And the driving force is coherent UV in the cell, and there is a microwave component, the ATP to ATP bond. And Dratch measured that. You can measure Kundalini in the microwave. So when that comes to a climax condition, the body can literally, it's a form of fire. But that fire can be controlled, which is what Kundalini is. And that's a whole other discussion. But that is literally a way to drive the plasma implosion.
And in my spreadsheet, the microwave frequencies are used for accelerating the transmutation. So
I know Dan had a sort of Kundalini awakening, but have you had, working with this electrical theories, spiritual insights and awakening?
Yeah, I would say so, yeah.
What's happened to you, if you want to talk about that, and maybe reference that in terms of the electrical field?
A lucid dreamer.
I did some lucid dreaming, but I think this all started when Bill Ramsey gave me this tape called Reismana Cosmology, which was basically music of the spheres. And he said that this thing had a better range of frequencies than the human ear could discern. Uh-huh. So, okay, fine. I had the Pat Flanagan's original Neurophone,
right.
Plugged it into my cassette player, and then I just put the transducers on, and I just laid down, and oh my gosh. I mean, whew, boy, that was something else again.
What happened?
It's like I just exploded out into space. It was like an instant epiphany.
Wow. So what did you get? What came to you? What knowledge, visions about your work?
Yeah. A lot of it. I mean, a lot of the stuff that was in the Glimpses book came out of some of that.
Talk about the Glimpses book that you wrote.
Okay. Yeah. Glimpses of Epiphany. And it's going to be published tentatively by UK.
And what's in the book? What do you write about?
It's basically a lot of my musings, essentially. And some of it's on early electrical engineering and where we went wrong. And some of it's on the Kosky, but a third of it's on the Kosky-Frost experiment. Because what I wanted to do was find out if this is for real or not. Mm-hmm. And when you do any kind of investigative reporting or any kind of research, you're looking for three different points of confirmation. So
what are you looking for?
I'm looking for three different...
Oh, just three different...
Three different references.
Whatever they are.
Right. So at first I thought, well, this might be fake because you go to the October issue of Science and Invention and it's basically refuting everything from September. So, oh my gosh, I mean, the whole thing's fake. But then I went back to the original article from Radio Umschau in Germany.
What year are we talking?
1927.
Okay.
So went to 1927, Radio Umschau, got the original German. Guy by the name of Steve Cherichevitz, Gesundheit.
German.
Yeah. So, anyways, Steve Cherichevitz translates this thing from High German. My High German wasn't that good. So he translates it, and I said, okay, Steve, is this for real? And he said, yes. He said, without a doubt. And I said, okay. So then I had a couple other sources that I checked with. And they said, oh, yeah, yeah, I mean, this actually took place. I mean, this was in the Telefunken laboratory. They did it.
What did they actually do?
This is a quartz crystal activated with conjugate radio frequencies that creates so much thrust. The amount of gravity it makes.
Yes.
It makes gravity.
Yeah.
I mean, which changes and creates anti-gravity.
Well,
gravity in whatever direction you want to go in.
Creates lift.
And that's the essential element that that Gallimore did with his grazer.
So the quartz levitate? It actually...
Yeah,
it levitated, and it actually lifted 800 times its own weight.
In the levitation?
Yes.
And this got activated by how?
Conjugate radio frequencies.
Yeah. What did they actually do?
777 kilohertz on the horizontal axis. The interesting thing, though, is that when I looked at the photograph, the two broadcasting plates they were using had this black finish on them. I said, what was that stuff? And then it turns out that there's a particular type of carbon that was used to produce a phase conjugate replica or a PCR replica. Well, when you do that, you actually change the transverse wave into a longitudinal wave. So they're broadcasting this longitudinal wave into the quartz crystal. Now, they also had on the top and bottom, they had high voltage going on there, but...
Well, there's always longitudinal waves going through. It was amplified, though, right?
Right,
yeah,
right.
Okay.
Right. So then this is about 2,000 watts worth going in.
Mm.
So quite a bit of energy. Well, not a lot. I mean, we're not talking about megawatts going in, but just something that you would see in a typical electrical lab back in the 1920s.
Okay.
So
then what?
Anyway, then they had high voltage on the vertical axis. Now, also interesting, because that high voltage was probably half to full wave rectified with almost no filtering. So now you had, at that time, 50 hertz going in. So you had 50 hertz in this axis, and then you had that beat frequency with whatever's on the horizontal axis. So you get four-wave mixing going on in here.
Called phase conjugate.
Right. Mm-hmm. So as a result, you've got this four-wave complex wave going, four-wave mixing complex wave inside the crystal. And that's what was producing this lift effect.
When you say four-wave mixing, visualize pine cones learning to kiss noses across pairs of opposite parallel axes.
I get that.
That's the vision.
I get that.
That's classic for phase conjugate optics, but very few people understand it in other spectra.
Yeah. So can that be duplicated in machines then? I mean, like
it could be duplicated now.
Yeah. In any crystal matrix, basically, it's a gravitational thrust device, literally warping space.
So why aren't people doing that?
Because you need to understand the relationship of gravity to electromagnetics fundamentally.
But you understand it. You could build this.
Of course.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, it's not that hard.
Not that hard.
There's lots of these things that are ready to build, but education is limited.
You could build an anti-gravity machine today.
There's four different ways to do it, at least.
And no,
right here.
Well, when I did the warp coil originally with the fluid, I lost about 5 to 20% of the weight of the coil. So
you already
did it.
Give me the example of a Celtic knot, non-compensated spin. So you're winding a bobbin around what looks like a Celtic knot. Why does that make gravity? Very simple.
There's a non-compensated component, and it's a series of loops on the top of that Celtic knot. That's not compensated for the other part. So you look at the Celtic knot, and there's one component.
Very simple.
It's going like...
Yeah.
It's like a triangle knot.
Right.
Like a triangle knot.
Yeah.
Right.
But because there's a spin on one axis that's not balanced on the opposing axis, just like a trout turbine,
creates anti-gravity.
If the geometry...
Yeah, a force component. Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And if you optimize that, you have what they called impulse power.
Well, let me just ask you something basic about electricity. When they started to run electricity through copper wires, they didn't realize it had a magnetic effect originally. There was that was a component of electricity.
Oh, yeah. They knew about the magnetism. They didn't know about the longitudinal aspect or the potential.
Well, they still don't, do they?
Well, they, no, they don't.
So what?
They're ignoring it.
How does that show up then?
Well, the relation of the electric to magnetic component is just like looking at that spiral on the torus. The component that's rotating is perpendicular to the component that's going this way versus this way. That's electrical to magnetic. It's always perpendicular. But now if you take that translation and look at a z-axis motion, the longitudinal component, so people think electric and magnetic can be separate. They can never be separate. It's flux moving on the surface of a torus. The inertia that's going around this axis perpendicular to this axis is electric to magnetic.
Well, Nassim Harmin said there's only really two forces, the electromagnetic pushing things out and gravity pulling things in.
But that doesn't describe the...
They're not separate.
That's the point. They're not separate.
What, gravity and electromagnetism?
And how electromagnetism...
Well, there are two axes of the same pole.
How electromagnetics creates gravity is the way on the flow down the center of the vortex, a portion of that inertia accelerates, adding multiplying phase velocities, produces some acceleration toward center because of the geometry of that spiral path. And that acceleration toward center is called gravity. It's acceleration of charge. Gravity is acceleration of charge. It's not like the acceleration. It is the acceleration of charge.
So could we actually build little cars that had anti-gravity machines?
Absolutely. It's child's play. It's nothing.
We could have a whole... Yeah.
Yes, we could. It replaces all forms of transport, especially rocketry, and you don't even feel the turns.
And it would be safe.
And I want my hoverboard, after all.
And it would be safe. They wouldn't have to crash or fall.
Remember, to understand our relationship to gravity is to understand what makes the planet field itself centripetal and self-organizing. So the same centripetal field that's holding our atmosphere is what we tap when we tap electromagnetics from gravity. So calling it free energy is a mistake because always the gravity field is feeding, cohering the vacuum. Mm-hmm. And so we should not call it free energy. You know, the Atlanteans made earthquakes and Tesla made earthquakes because they didn't understand that. So we need a little education before we do it. And it starts by not calling it free energy.
So also, it's a bad idea to make power plants running on, you know, so-called free energy because, I mean, you're basically producing all these longitudinal ripples in the vacuum. So instead of using centralized power systems,
It's distributed.
We use decentralized.
So everyone has their own little power system in their house.
Right.
Pine cones don't upset the gravity field.
So and that's possible. Everyone can have their own little
tell them
free energy source.
But tell them, Bill, how we prove this. We prove that you walk into a nuclear plant and you prove to the employees why their bones are falling apart.
Well,
because if you're near to fission, the local binding energy is decreased, which means every atom literally starts falling apart measurably. And there's a way to
even
measure.
Even if it's not radiating.
That's right. Because
just the energy of it.
The local every atom.
The act of nuclear fission actually consumes binding energy.
Just being near it. Without even being exposed to radiation.
It's like the kids are tearing apart their own nest. Whereas if you're near fusion energy, the opposite is true.
Mm-hmm.
So you can immediately prove whether your source of energy is tearing apart your universe or putting it together.
So what's the thing in CERN doing?
It ain't good.
Yeah.
But tell them how binding energy is measured.
Okay, well, that's another thing. Wilbert Smith, way back in the 60s, actually had this binding energy meter.
He's the Canadian guy who got into UFOs.
Right. So what he did was he had this horse hair on one side and a spring in the other.
Horse hair?
A horse hair.
Hair. On one side.
Right.
It's just it's a horse hair under tension.
Okay.
Right. So he had a horse hair, then it was hooked up to a needle on a meter. So when the horse hair had more binding energy, it actually moved the meter needle.
And horse hair is living biology. And so when the horse hair is attracted to itself, that means the location is sacred.
How do you build up binding energy?
It's the opposite of a fission plant. Fusion is the one answer.
How do you build?
Restored centripetal force.
It's analog, obviously, but you basically just have a horse hair on one side, and it's moving a needle in the middle. So on one side you have the hair and the tension on that. Then you have the tension on a spring. So if the horse hair has less binding energy, it's going to stretch more. So when it has more, it's going to contract.
So it tells you whether your location is safe.
This explains wrinkles on the face?
No. No. What it explains is this. It explains
other things.
It explains why the magnetic map of your bed and your house and your yard in the city needs to look like a rose. Because if it does, then the binding energy is growing in that area and evolution is possible.
That's the womb energy, isn't it?
It's the fractal physics of feng shui.
That's why things grow inside of women.
Absolutely. Whereas if your local magnetic map is a square magnetic electrosmog poison like New York City, then the local binding energy is dying. Or if you live near a fission plant.
Okay.
So fission is a sin against nature.
I'm going to sleep in a rose then.
Or
the
exactly.
Rose bed, a bed of roses.
Make a magnetic map of your bed and learn how to dream.
Yeah. So, okay, wrapping up, we've covered a lot of ground here.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't have to say exactly what you're working on, but where are you going with this? I mean, what new theories have yet to be discovered, in electro engineering? I mean, are there new horizons?
Oh, absolutely.
In which areas? I mean, are we looking in for?
We're looking at self-recharging batteries. We're looking at plasma interferometry solution of fusion. We're looking at replacing all forms of thrust on the planet.
With what? With these?
Yeah, absolutely. Crystal. But it all starts with understanding
electrogravity. That's another interesting point, because back around the late 50s, early 60s, and that was when it was called goodbye gravity. The solution to gravity, thing was back around the...
What was the solution to gravity?
The solution to gravity was supposedly electrogravity. And there were several different... actually, like 50 or 60 articles, coming to think of it. I have a whole drawer in my filing cabinet on this thing. But at that time, it was just around the corner. We knew what gravity was. We were going to conquer it.
Uh-huh.
And then around 60, 62, suddenly, bang, the whole thing, the lid on the pressure cooker went back on.
Why is that?
Government.
It went.
So we really did have the answer back then.
We had the answer.
And they found the answer.
Well, the military wanted control. It's what Eisenhower warned. You know, the military complex is going to take over and you are going to be in trouble. Who decided that the supercapacitor battery in the Abrams tank would not be released to Boeing? Who made that decision? It was not a democratic decision, Mr. Obama, right? And that is the result, is that everything, I won't carry
on. No, it's okay.
Yeah, I mean, we can go on a rant for another half hour.
But where were you going with it? What were you saying, Bill, then? That so the new horizons for your field, advanced electro engineering, is to... Mm-hmm. Go back to where we left off in the 60s.
It's real unified field thinking. Yeah.
Actually, it's a double-pronged approach.
Yeah, tell me.
One is to go back to electrical engineering prior to Heaviside and to find out where we went wrong there.
With Maxwell.
Exactly.
With Maxwell. Mm-hmm. Second is to go back to prior to the 1960s, when we're just at the verge of doing anti-gravity.
Real electrogravitics.
And pick that up. Well, obviously, the government did pick it up and went somewhere with it.
Well, obviously, yeah.
Everything is seen through a military lens, and that's a problem. Because ultimately, in effect, you don't have a body unless you're making your own gravity. You know, we're dreaming about cars that make their own gravity, and that's cool. Mm-hmm. But the real lesson is going to be when we understand how to make our own gravity. Because until then, we're going to be pushed around.
But what about when the Earth loses its electromagnetic field, when the poles reverse?
And when we lose our atmosphere.
Well, how does that affect us? Because we're electromagnetic beings, and we don't have an electromagnetic field.
It means we have to learn how to make our grid fractal, the dodecahedral Earth grid, the anti-gravity world grid, that when we repair the fractality, the dodecahedral geometry, the long-wave magnetics of the Earth grid, then the gravity field of the Earth is self-organizing and stable, and atmosphere comes back. And that's called a dream spell.
But that was the problem on Mars, wasn't it? They lost their atmosphere, and they lost it because...
Atmosphere maintenance must be understood electrically.
Mm-hmm. Why did they lose their atmosphere?
Well, that's the total recall problem, but and that gets into the ET politics of the Draco's not wanting oxygen, and it's just a whole other story.
Okay, we'll get into the whole Draco politics on another show.
But anyway, if we can get a grassroots movement going on this thing, It's the 100th monkey syndrome, because if enough people become aware of this.
Aware of that we lost Maxwell's real equation.
Right, and that we have this suppressed technology.
Right.
Then if we have a general raising of consciousness about the whole thing, and that's a big problem, because in this society, that's the very reason why they're de-emphasizing the sciences.
Right. Kids don't study science anymore.
Because they don't want people to know this stuff.
Because it's too self-empowering.
Right. It's self-empowering. If you want to disempower a people, you take away their ability to manipulate their environment.
Yeah. So it becomes government-controlled science, and then it's like the Nazis. They pick their scientists, and everyone else is educated on fast food and reality.
So self-empowerment really understanding spirituality as science. Truly.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it is a science.
Absolutely.
Consciousness is a science.
And the physics is more beautiful mm-hmm. than mm-hmm. any spirituality. Spirituality leads to physics.
Mm-hmm. So we educate enough of the public on this thing. And we also need to educate the younger generation. I remember when Bearden was in front of the USPA and he said, "I see an ocean of gray hair." I said, "Where are the young people?" There weren't any.
Huh. But there are people studying science. Science is still taught in colleges, universities, full of science and technology.
Around Europe, every audience I speak to, I ask the young people, who studied any physics? Who studied any electronics? Zero.
That's a big problem.
Zero. And there's nobody thinking radically about electromagnetics in disciplined terms.
Well, if Maxwell, coming out of nowhere, out of the box, with no electrical background, because there wasn't any back mm-hmm. then, could create these formulas, why couldn't someone start from zero again?
To feel themselves riding the wave.
And reinvent mm-hmm. logically what Maxwell logically put together.
A lot of people are doing that.
I mean, why did it take 150 years to do that? I mean, because they were going on what they were educated
in. This gets into the morphic field of the Rupert
Sheldrake
stuff.
Talk about that a little bit.
Right. I mean, a lot of these concepts are in the morphic field of the entire planet. Mm-hmm. And inventions are coming up over and over and over again, even though they're suppressed.
Right. I mean,
they're popping up again. People are just receiving this thing like they're a radio set. And I think energy can neither be created nor destroyed. Ideas can't be destroyed either. They're out there.
Right.
It's the nature of DNA to achieve that perfected distribution, and it's the nature of successful death.
Well, I do know Hal Puthoff. We did talk about him. He is developing something like probably government. What would you say to someone like Hal about what you know is true? What would you say? He's a scientist. I mean, mm-hmm. what would you like to say to him? Wake up and smell the coffee.
No, yeah, pretty much, yeah. No,
but, I mean, because he's been working on this stuff, I mean, for years.
Just do not allow the military agenda to overshadow the social meaning, really. You know?
And the social responsibility of the scientist.
So you guys are really social scientists.
That's the point. Absolutely. Yeah. It's a perfect... Look, the perfectly immortal wave is the perfectly shareable wave. The only thing we've been talking about so far is how a wave becomes perfectly distributed and therefore perfectly shareable. And that's phase conjugate or fractal. It's the nature of successful death. It's the nature of what DNA is doing. And when we build cities that look like that, then we're going to build a capacitor that looks like that. And that is the solution to the energy crisis.
That is a shift in paradigm.
Absolutely.
And a whole new reality.
The new city is going to look like a pine cone. It's going to be made of the same materials. And it's going to be the exact kind of capacitor that is absolutely the end of the energy crisis.
And that will generate energy because it will...
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And the plants will grow faster. We know that a seed grows faster in the right kind of capacitor. The same kind of capacitor that increases attention, the same kind of capacitor that reduces radioactivity.
Interesting. Well, okay. Any final words, Bill? I mean, you've dedicated your life to sort of this kind of, mm-hmm. I wouldn't say avant-garde, but in a way people listening may not understand some of what you're saying, but it's really cutting edge.
And again, that article, fractalfield.com/mathematicsoffusion, is a very good introduction.
Okay, and your website?
It's Bill, co-authorship.
Okay. Yeah. And what's the website again?
Fractalfield.com/mathematicsoffusion. It's
co-authored by Bill. It ends with the film from Bearden. It's a good introduction to this conversation.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And if people are interested in the technology, there's Implosion Group, Breakthrough Technologies, Purify.com. We have many projects that are related to this, and they're all around this central theme of restored centripetal and forces, implosion.
And the book that's going to come out by you is called?
Glimpses of Epiphany.
Glimpses of Epiphany. And that epiphany was?
Just this entire technology.
And it's like, wow, one day you woke up and said, something's wrong with these old equations.
Instead of wake up and smell the coffee, it's wake up and cohere the vacuum.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, okay, so now I'll let people know where they can find that.
Yes, sure. It'll be on that same web link.
All right. Well,
yeah, we can put a PDF up on there.
That would be great. If you want to put a PDF, I'll even put it on my website,
too. We'll put it at the same link. Mathematics of Fusion.
Okay, I'd love to. I mean, if you don't mind, you'd rather have it doesn't matter. You want people to have the information.
Oh, absolutely.
Because this will change people's minds.
We are a shareable wave.
Okay. Well, thank you all. I'll have to listen to this program a few times.
Just for what it's worth, what we have in the book and the reason that they don't want to publish it is that it can be considered a unified field theory.
And what's wrong with that? They've been looking for that.
Well, it's because if you have a unified field theory, that means that the next thing you can get into is reality engineering.
Which means what?
Real self-empowerment.
What do you mean by reality engineering?
Because once you have this model of reality, now you can begin changing things.
Like what?
When you make a centripetal force, it is literally the physics of creation. But creation occurs when charge is implosively compressed. It's true of the nature of mind.
So what would you change? Would you move this door over there is
we call it a flame in the mind.
But what do you mean, Bill, though, about changing things? What do you mean? Like, what ideas do you have about changing reality?
Well, changing the entire paradigm so that instead of a military-industrial complex controlling everything, then we have a
personal sovereignty.
Yes. I mean, we have real conscience inside of science instead of it being run by the military.
Wow.
It means that, you know, the extent to which a wave becomes shareable inside you is the extent that wave serves everyone.
Yeah, because we're part of the whole.
That's right. It's the very nature of successful death. Mm-hmm. So once what's called pure intention is recognized for what it is electrically, is pure coherence, climax form, is conjugate or fractal.
Mm-hmm. Well, last question. Was the Philadelphia experiment, did that happen? Did they actually move the... Because they knew what you knew, and they actually activated with huge electrical fields.
Oh, yeah, they were conjugating.
There's a whole story behind that one, too.
Behind the Philadelphia experiment and Tesla technology.
Von Neumann,
And they moved it. Did they move it to Montauk 40 years in the future, as they say?
That gets into another 30 minutes.
All right, well... Could we do a show on that?
To be continued.
All right. I've been talking to Dan Winter and Bill Donovan here, really at the cutting edge of science and new realities and shifting paradigms. And your website again, Dan?
Well, goldenmean.info and also fractalfield.com relating to this article, fractalfield.com/mathematicsoffusion.
Okay, and Bill Donovan, you don't have a website, but you're hooked up with it.
That Mathematics of Fusion is Bill's work.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, very exciting, very detailed, very amazing. Okay.
Thank you for your open mind.
It had to be open, taking some of those concepts. So, this is Alan Steinfeld here, being educated by two of the top scientists, thinkers, I think, in the world, really developing something that will be transformative to the century, to the people of the Earth, to science of the future. And you heard it here. So thanks for listening. You could find me at newrealities.com. You can email me at newrealities@earthlink.net.
We're in the new reality. It's all cool.
It's all cool. Thanks for listening. Thanks, BBS.
Good night.